Welcome to the Nonprofit News Feed, nonprofitnewsfeed.com, bringing you the best news from the best sector, news from a nonprofit perspective and what matters. This show brought to you by Whole Whale, a B Corp digital agency. Thanks for joining us. This week on the Nonprofit News Feed, we're talking about the major loophole exposed by the OpenAI lawsuit. We're talking about NYPD getting called out for kettling and some information on the map of where DEI is being under attack from a legislative standpoint. My name is George Weiner. I'm the chief whaler of Whole Whale, and we have Nick Azoulay, digital strategist at Whole Whale. Nick, how's it going?
It's going great, George. Super excited for today. I think we have an interesting one. I'll start us off by talking about the clash over nonprofit promises and Silicon Valley profits, as we phrased it. So just a day ago, we learned that Elon Musk is suing OpenAI, alleging it strayed from its nonprofit mission. Remember, OpenAI was originally incorporated as a nonprofit. This comes reporting from Axios and others. But part of the dispute lies in Musk's claim that OpenAI, which he helped found, remember, reneged on its nonprofit commitment to operate as an open source entity under its original 501c3 status. And George, you and I have our disagreements with Musk, but he brings up a good point in the next part, which is Musk essentially asserts that OpenAI used that nonprofit model to generate pre-tax, fully deductible contributions as a form of seed funding, only then to go private and renege on that 501c3 status. So the lawsuit alleges this is an egregious shift from its original mission and could potentially highlight how 501c3s as a tax-exempt status for organizations could serve as a vehicle to abuse. In the past, George, you and I have talked about how IKEA is owned by a nonprofit. Wink, wink, if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't. It's a little sketch. And George, this is, I think, opening up a can of worms that might deserve to be opened up, considering that, quite frankly, the regulation of nonprofits and that nonprofit status is continually kind of overlooked by the IRS. And Musk might be making an important point here about leveling the playing field and making sure that everyone plays by the same rules.
Yeah, we even talked about this, where it's a giant loophole in 501c3s and venture funding. Quite literally, like if I'm going to start a venture-funded, high capital-intensive project, why not make it a nonprofit? And then suddenly, all of the, wait a minute, not investments, donations are going to this greater good until we achieve what we were trying to do. And then suddenly, we've got a for-profit entity that happens to issue shares to the people that made donations to get that access and fund that project. And it's something that deserves greater scrutiny because it is a loophole you could drive a truck full of money through, and it has already had a truck full of money driven through. And so Elon Musk pointing this out, I will note, maybe coincidentally, because he's got a competing Grok product and he wouldn't mind slowing down OpenAI. Like, just let's just be clear, this guy, you can question the altruism associated with the action, of course, but it doesn't make the point less salient. And in particular, in the lawsuit, he is pointing at that GPT-4 more black box, less transparent creation of what they did there, which was the industry leading GPT up until Anthropic Claude 3's Opus announced just a couple days ago has beat it in the LLM benchmarking tools. So I'm hopeful that this leads to additional scrutiny because it is a playbook that should be used and abused if it is not resolved, and it is a misuse of the 501c3 tax exempt nature of nonprofits in America.
Yeah, George, I think that's exactly right. And if not for anything, this shines a light on that particular aspect of how organizations start and will hopefully bring about transparency and reform.
All right. Actually, before we go into our next thing, this is like behind the curtain. This won't end up on YouTube. We'll cut this out. But I want to share a bit about what I'm about to do, which is talk about a brief history of where the tax exempt in nonprofits came from. And I'm doing this because one, we're nonprofit geeks and it's interesting to us. And two is because we also put this on YouTube. And on YouTube, we're beginning to do a lot of testing and chopping things up. And one of the things we realize is that you can have these news clips that have, you know, a few week to a month lifespan. What we're starting to do is create informational bites that are under 60 seconds so that we can get onto YouTube Shorts, into long-term search, and build our brand. So I just, you know, as a tactic, want to share that with, you know, folks that listen to the podcast, because this won't be on YouTube, but remind you, we do have that channel there where we're testing all of these things, where we take this time, we take this video, we chop it up and try to get the most out of this as possible. So forgive me for if this seems like a history lesson, but I'm doing two things at once, but I'm also showing and sharing behind the curtain of why we're doing it.
I love it, George. Should I tee you up for your video hit?
for the shameless search and you can listen on. Yeah, let's go with that.
All right. George, I'd love to know a little bit more about the background of what 501c3 means.
So why are donations to 501c3 nonprofits tax exempt? Well, actually, the origins predate the formation of the U.S. Like, before we had all of the, you know, constitution and organizing bodies, look, we were all about organizations like schools, churches, and member-serving associations like fraternal societies that really were the glue of our society. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about this in the 1840s and has many quotes about being shocked about how, you know, when needs be, they almost always gave each other faithful support, talking about our associations. From a legal standpoint, it all legally began with Revenue 1917, which established that the tax deductions to 501 should be for charitable organizations. And that was because the increased income tax rates were rising due to World War I. So it's because of tax rates in World War I that is allowed. And so basically the government believes that charitable organizations play a valuable role in society and essential services, which is why they allow it to be tax exempt. The more you know.
The more you know. I love to hear it.
All right. Now back to our regular scheduled programming, please.
Of course. George, I will say that was quite impressive. You have a career on the History Channel. But that aside,
nonprofit. I want to take all 10 people that listen to the Nonprofit History Channel. Yeah.
The Nonprofit History Channel. It's thrilling over there. We got to get that aliens guy in. I got no good transition to this. This next story comes from Gothamist, local public reporting here in New York City. And the title of this story is that the NYPD is now legally mandated to respond to protests differently. If we think back to the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer of 2020, there was lots of concern and criticism of NYPD's crowd control tactics, chiefly the use of kettling, which is essentially boxing in protesters to maximize the number of arrests that they're able to make, as well as overall kind of violence and the chaos in some of the policing tactics there. And we wanted to bring this back to this podcast in particular, because I think it's important to highlight some of the slow moving work that a lot of great nonprofits are doing in the backgrounds that are really helping reform some institutions and things like policing, which is something that everyone was talking about in 2020. And now, you know, kind of falls to the background. To bring it to the forefront again, this is the result of the settlement of a lawsuit brought by the New York Civil Liberties Union, as well as the Legal Aid Society, two phenomenal legal advocacy organizations. Of course, there was a long, drawn-out legal process, but the successful settlement here has gone into effect now. It's legally now mandated that the department ban the use of kettling. There are four-tiered response systems to better calibrate the NYPD's response based on conditions at demonstrations, as well as restricting the deployment of the NYPD's often criticized strategic response group. And we think that this is really important because it shows the work, the slow-moving, kind of boring, but extremely important work of civil liberties and civil rights organizations that are working to reform policing behind the scenes. It's slow, hard work, but it is happening, and those organizations deserve a shout out. And this comes, by the way, as the NYPD last year paid out $114 million in wrongful settlement conduct claims or wrongful conduct settlements. So of course, policing is a huge problem for New Yorkers and something that is encountered often. So just truly excellent work and an important follow-up from a story that doesn't get enough attention in America, and that is policing.
That $114 million, by the way, in those lawsuits could be reapplied toward healthier policing practices, compensation, you name it, as opposed to being attacked for doing the wrong thing, which is just going to create a more efficient and safer system and hopefully help the nonprofits, especially advocacy organizations, planning future protests to do it in a safer, healthier way.
Yes, exactly. All right, I'll take us to our next story. This one comes from NBC News, and they have a great map that we'll put up in the show notes and is also in our newsletter at nonprofitnewsfeed.com. But it highlights which states have introduced or passed anti-DEI bills. DEI, of course, referring to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the backlash to DEI is increasing as it becomes demagogued, particularly in conservative and Republican political circles. More than 30 states have introduced bills to ban or limit DEI efforts during the current legislative session. This follows, of course, going back to the George Floyd and Black Lives Matter protest of 2020, which really centered DEI in corporate America, in nonprofit America, in higher education. These bills are really in a backlash to that, I would say. So states like Florida, Texas, and Utah have kind of led the charge here on implementing that legislation, prohibiting DEI funding in higher education and government, the state really leveraging the power it has over things like public schools and state schools to kind of push these agendas. Critics claim DEI promotes division. Supporters argue it's vital for societal progress. Color me a supporter of the importance of diversity and inclusion and listening to each other and not being racist. A lot of this comes amid racist dog whistles, in my opinion. But this is a major flashpoint in the American political landscape. Tons of public institutions, nonprofit institutions get caught up in these debates as well. You're seeing this in higher education. You see this in all sorts of public spaces. So, George, this map in particular really does show where efforts are taking place. And I wonder if you have any further thoughts on this.
When I look at the legal hooks that seemed to land, and you can talk about, you know, capital DEI and how, as a term, it has been loaded both by progressives and conservatives with things I think have drifted from the original purpose. The legal hook seems to be around quotas. And when quotas are implemented, you are actually in violation of the law for whatever. A diverse process is different than a rigid quota system. And so I would say for DEI practitioners and communicators out there, I would look at that very specifically in terms of how when DEI is implemented, you're careful to say a rigid quota versus a diverse process are not the same thing.
I think those are some important thoughts there. All right, George, I think we could use a feel-good story. All right, this one comes from Time, and it is 10 surprising facts about Women's History Month, which we are now in. So for those who don't know, Women's History Month originated from a local week-long celebration in Santa Rosa, California in 1978, timed with the International Women's Day on March 8th. And it took several years for Women's History Month to become federally recognized in the U.S. The Congress passed a law designating March as Women's History Month in 1987, and the U.S. President issues an annual proclamation designating Women's History Month every year since 1995. And the theme of this year's Women's History Month, harking back to our last story, is, quote, women who advocate for equity, diversity, and inclusion. So we can see the tides are flowing on these kind of hot button topics, but happy National Women's Month.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Nick. All right. I do have a question for you, Nick.
I'm all ears.
All right. This is what happens when dad jokes meet hashtag nonprofits. How do you shop for impact projects on Heifer International? How do you shop for impact projects on Heifer International?
Is that the one where you can like adopt a sheep or something?
Yeah, you can go through its itemized support for things like cows, animals, and projects internationally.
I see. I see. George, I don't know.
A cattle log?
That's good. That's good. I see what you did there.
I made a bad dad joke. Exactly what I did. All right, Nick. Thanks for helping us understand the news. See you out there.
Thanks, George.
This has been the Nonprofit Newsfeed Summary of the Week. Thanks for joining us. As always, you can find resources at nonprofitnewsfeed.com. And don't forget to sign up for our weekly email summaries of the best news from the best sector.